Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of How We Survive. It's a podcast from Marketplace. In 1986, before I was a journalist, I was flying for the Navy.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It was the Cold War, and my first deployments were intercepting Russian bombers. Today, though, there's another threat out there. Climate change.
This could be the warmest year on record.
Climate change is here.
Temperatures here are warming faster than anywhere on Earth.
And while the threat seems new, the Pentagon's been funding studies on climate change since the 1950s.
I think we will put our troops and our forces at higher risk if we don't recognize the impact of climate change.
This season, we go to the front lines of the climate crisis to see how the military is preparing for the threat. Listen to How We Survive, wherever you get your podcasts.
Attention shifts to Israel's advance into Lebanon while Palestinians in Gaza are still suffering.
More and more Palestinians are losing their life. If it's not from bullets, it's from starvation or it's from lack of medical care.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The latest from Gaza nearly a year after Hamas militants attacked Israel. Plus, how that conflict has impacted U.S.-Israeli relations.
Once Israeli operations started in Gaza, that's where cracks began to show.
Also today, Taiwan is hit by one of the strongest typhoons in memory, shutting down the island.
And Irish hurling, the oldest sport you've never heard of.
We know this because of ancient Irish law tracts and of manuscripts kept in Irish monasteries from the medieval period.
What a single tree has to do with the sport today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us this Thursday.
Israel sent out more warnings to evacuate to residents in southern Lebanon earlier today, including people in a major city north of a UN-established buffer zone, an indication of a wider Israeli invasion of Lebanon.
Israeli airstrikes continue in South Beirut, recorded there overnight by the French news agency AFP. More than 1,200 people have been killed, according to Lebanese health officials, and at least 8 Israeli soldiers have died in the fighting.
Meanwhile, health officials in Gaza say Israeli forces killed more than 50 people near the city of Khan Yunis yesterday. The Israeli military said it also struck a school sheltering displaced people while targeting Hamas fighters. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with a doctor at a hospital in Khan Yunis and starts our coverage.
On Tuesday night, Dr. Majid Jaber had finished work for the day and was about to get some rest. Around midnight, he heard some loud noise. Once again, the war had come to the doorsteps of the European hospital where he works.
Artillery shells, the drones, the quadcopters did not stop.
Then the tanks rolled in.
We were hearing the engines and, you know, the chains moving closer to us. We were hearing the machine guns shooting.
Jaber and his colleagues were in survival mode. They stayed away from the windows and hunkered down inside the hospital.
We feared for our lives that night, and this is one of the very rare nights that I really feared for myself.
The attack lasted for 7 hours, Jaber says. The artillery didn't hit the hospital, but no one slept.
In the morning, when the army withdrew from the area, we had many bodies delivered to the hospital that were killed.
He counted at least a dozen. The exact death toll is hard to know, he says, because bodies still remain under the rubble and the first responders can't get to them. Next week marks a year since Hamas fighters stormed across the border into Israel. Israel says some 1,200 people were killed and 250 taken hostage. Hamas still holds some of those hostages. Israel's response has made most of Gaza uninhabitable.
More and more Palestinians are losing their lives. If it's not from bullets, it's from starvation or it's from lack of medical care.
Hani Al-Mathoun lives in the U.S. and runs a soup kitchen in northern Gaza from afar. His parents and siblings are there. He says the Israeli army isn't letting people or goods into or out of that part of Gaza. The soup kitchen distributes hot meals to about 800 families a day, Al-Mathoun says. Pasta, rice, whatever they can get their hands on.
So we go and buy the produce. Sometimes we forage things, you know, like the greenery.
fruits like persimmons and melons, he says.
If we get it and it comes as a gift from nature, it's one of the few things that the Palestinians are sustaining themselves with right now.
The food is desperately needed on the ground. Al-Mathoun shares videos with me of people lining up to get their hands on a warm meal. It's chaotic. They clamor and reach on top of one another to get their empty pots to the distributors. Aid and food deliveries into Gaza have dropped to their lowest in 7 months, according to the United Nations. Israel controls anything that enters the enclave and imposes restrictions on items that it considers could undermine its security. As a result, for many people in Gaza, food has become a luxury they can't afford.
My mom was telling me one banana cost her $13. One banana, $13. The carton of egg is $110.
Aid workers on the ground are doing what they can. Gavin Kelleher with the NGO Norwegian Refugee Council has been in Gaza since April, and he tells me that the conditions are extremely difficult.
This morning we had to consider, do we go ahead with distributing water to a site that still has bodies on the ground inside of it, or do we deprive water from the populations who need it so much?
They plan to try again today, he says. Kelleher says the aid workers themselves are under threat. Last week, he and a group of others were traveling in a convoy to get aid to northern Gaza. He says they had coordinated with the Israeli Defense Forces and had all the required paperwork.
And still, when we tried to cross the checkpoints to get into northern Gaza, IDF on the ground opened fire to the right of our convoy. Tanks approached us, extremely hostile.
Kelleher says they decided to head back given the tense situation. The Israeli Defense Forces didn't respond to my questions about the incident by airtime. Back at the European hospital, Dr. Majid Jaber says he is exhausted. A year ago, he was planning to go abroad to continue his education, not even imagining the kind of life he's living right now.
Most of us here are, like the rest of the world, we have ambitions. We had plans to live a very decent, dignified life. And now we've lost everything. We've lost our houses, our livelihoods, loved ones.
The worst part, he says, is that there seems to be no end in sight. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The wild weather we've been having all over the globe has just hit Taiwan. Typhoon Kratom made landfall in Taiwan's third biggest city earlier today. Two people are confirmed dead directly from the storm, and another 9 deaths resulted when a fire broke out in a hospital during the storm on the island's southeast. Reporter Ashish Valentine is in Taipei.
So the typhoon made landfall in Xiaogang, which is a neighborhood of Taiwan's second biggest city, Kaohsiung. Kaohsiung's a major port city, and it's also a major industrial area in Taiwan. The storm brought wind speeds of over 85 miles an hour and several feet of rain. Over 100,000 homes are without power, and about 38,000 soldiers from the military are on standby to help with evacuation and recovery. Kaohsiung is full of buildings made with sheet metal, factories and homes and things like that. Here's a video from Twitter showing one of those sheet metal buildings getting clean pulled apart.
Wow, that is intense.
And I spoke with Zhang Qian-Ting-Yu. He's lived his whole life in Kaohsiung.
In my life, gone through hundreds of typhoons, and I think it's the most powerful one.
Ashish, I mean, Taiwan gets hit by a lot of major storms. What made this one so consequential?
Right. So when Taiwan gets hit by typhoons, usually the typhoon hits the east coast first. Most of the people actually live on the west coast. So that means that by the time the storm actually gets to the western half, where most of the people live, it's lost a lot of strength. So this is the first time in about 50 years that Kaohsiung and the industrial southern part of Taiwan was hit by a storm of this magnitude. So as a result, these western urban areas got hit in a way that they haven't been hit before. Now, my source in Kaohsiung, Zhang Jian, he was there when the typhoon Gaimi arrived in July, which was Taiwan's other major typhoon this season. He said there were heavy rains both times, but what stood out to him this time was the wind.
I've been living here for 30 years. I have never seen or I have never experienced such a strong wind. We are all very terrified by the strong wind now.
So what is the situation in the capital, Taipei?
So in the capital, Taipei, actually, it's a bit of a surprise because we had been expecting the typhoon to hit We've had schools and workplaces closed for about 2 days. And yet, if you look outside the window, all you see is some light rain and maybe some, not even some particularly strong winds. That's because of what meteorologists are calling some very weird phenomenon going on with the storm, where it slowed down much more than expected when it was in the Bashi Channel south of Taiwan. So those urban industrial areas in the southwest are suffering heavy winds and rain much longer than expected, while actually in the capital Taipei, at least some people feel that maybe the past 2 days of typhoon holidays might not have been so necessary.
So that weird dynamic, as meteorologists are calling it, how much of that weirdness might be due to climate change?
Yeah, so it's always tricky to look at one individual storm and say that something that happened is directly because of climate change. But I talked to Huang Chun-Xi. He's the deputy director of the Central Weather Administration's forecast center here in Taipei. He says climate change affects the big picture of typhoons in Taiwan.
With the higher sea surface temperature, we might have more intense typhoon. In recent years, the winter becomes shorter and the summer becomes longer. And we have the heavy rainfall more frequently, so the weather becomes more extreme.
So Huang says that as climate change gets worse, Taiwan will see its weather get even more weird over time.
That's reporter Ashish Valentine in Taipei, Taiwan.
Massachusetts is not the first place that comes to mind as a setting for a rodeo. It's a sport that conjures the American West. New England, not so much. But just a little bit south of our studio here in Boston, the rodeo tradition is alive and well thanks to a group of immigrants upholding their own cowboy culture. GBH's Esteban Bustillos has our story.
It's only about an hour from Boston, but the back road that leads to the New England's rodeo might as well lead to a different planet. Yeah. The parking lot is a sea of cowboy hats, boots, and pickup trucks. It's as country gets. Kelly Pina is the rodeo's strategic advisor and jokes that it's New England's best-kept secret.
Because nobody ever pictures a rodeo being in Massachusetts.
The New England's rodeo has been a hub for rodeo culture in the States. And it's also a lifeline for Brazilian immigrants who are immersed in the cowboy culture. Julia Oliveira is the bull riding producer at the rodeo. She also speaks fluent Portuguese, an important skill since at this rodeo, almost all the bull riders are Brazilian.
It's nice to have a place where they could come and feel comfortable and feel welcomed, especially since they're coming from another country, usually without even being able to speak English. So it's nice so that for them to come here and feel welcomed.
As soon as the gate opens, it's man versus nature. For a few electrifying seconds, the rider is locked in a mesmerizing dance that shakes the earth below. Supporters scream and holler. Gravity and thrashing bulls have a way of making sure the cowboys hit the ground. As terrifying as it looks, they all dust themselves off and hop back up. Wesley Gonsalves is Oliveira's uncle. He's been riding bulls most of his life. It's taken a toll on his body though, so he doesn't ride as much as he once did. He says bull riding and soccer are the big sports in his home country of Brazil. And having the rodeo in Norton is a big deal for him.
This is very important for us Brazilians. We have a lot of Brazilians here. The community of Brazilians in Massachusetts is big. But a lot of farm people here enjoy this a lot.
Here at the rodeo, everyone pitches in. For Pina, it's a far cry from her day job in health and safety.
Almost all of us have day jobs. This is just our side job that we're really passionate about.
The rodeo is a personal affair for Pina. Of course, she helps run it, but she's also a professional barrel racer. She zooms through the arena, looping around barrels on her horse. And her husband, Ed Pina, is one of the rodeo's announcers. He believes one of the best things about the rodeo is the bonds it creates.
You come here a few times, you're family. You work with us, you're blood no matter what. You know, it's about building our family bigger and teaching the next generation how to do our sport and to make sure our sport keeps going.
The New England Rodeo hopes to grow, but it also wants to remain like a tight-knit family, And whether that family is bull riders from Brazil or just folks from around this way, there's a place for nearly everyone at the rodeo. For the world, I'm Esteban Bustillos in Norton, Massachusetts.
Just ahead, Russia wants to stamp out any talk of people choosing not to have kids. Reaction to a new policy that cracks down on promoting a so-called child-free lifestyle. That is just ahead. You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Vladimir Putin is on a crusade to increase his country's birth rate. Data released in September showed births in Russia reaching the lowest level in 25 years, driven by emigration and the war in Ukraine. Last week, the government proposed a new law aiming to criminalize individuals, state employees, and companies who advocate being child-free. Mariana Muravieva is a professor of Russian law at the University of Helsinki, where she specializes in women's rights.
I wasn't surprised at all, and I was actually expecting that to happen. I honestly thought feminism would come first, but I guess that child-free ideology now is a priority in this difficult wartime demography, so feminism, I guess, is the next. But after what they did with the LGBTQI plus people and criminalized, obviously, not just the propaganda advocacy, but also being an LGBTQI person, things like that, ideology like that is to be expected.
Is it clear to you what enforcement of this proposed law would look like?
Well, unfortunately, it's not clear. We only can rely on a previous experience with the enforcement of the criminalization of propaganda promotion of LGBTQI plus ideology. What we've seen, that's going to be involving prosecution of any expression of child-free ideology. And it usually involves anything online, on the mass media, anything in the arts. So anything what we think about the freedom of expression and sort of visual and verbal expression, which would be considered child-free. Basically, everybody is a bit uncertain what child-free is. So is it promotion of women without children? Is it women saying they don't want children? Is it families saying they don't want children? So we are not certain yet. But so far, what we've seen is just a symbolic message. We want more children, so we don't want any child-free.
Yeah, so it sounds like you see it both as an attack on those who desire to be child-free and an attack on LGBTQ plus community as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a continuation of the whole idea that we prosecute or scapegoat people who we think don't contribute to demography, either directly or indirectly. Directly meaning don't have children, indirectly, you know, promoting ideologies that are not just about children or traditional family or traditional values. And as I said, next one is feminist to come. You probably will be interviewing me in a couple of months on that.
Okay. You mentioned the war in Ukraine in context of this law proposal. Why do you think this proposed law is happening now?
It's what we call the wartime legislation. The attempts or suggestions to ban child-free ideology were there before. So, I mean, there were several times it would come up in 17 and 18 and 19. So a lot of conservative, sort of semi-conservative organizations were criticizing so-called child-free ideology for quite some time now. So it's not a new thing. But the initiative to actually criminalize that, to put it into law, that is something that we've been seeing when the war against Ukraine started, and that is a part and parcel of that oppressive legislation into the freedom of expression, so to limit it, into the freedom of speech, into the freedom of opinion, or into anything that could lead to any criticism of the current regime.
Mariana, when you speak with friends in Russia and this topic comes up, having kids, having no kids, making babies under pressure from the government, what do you hear?
So when I talk actually to people who are younger, and I still have a lot of colleagues and we still sort of try to support the connections, a lot of them cannot imagine having children right this moment and in years to come. And I do understand them really well because they are absolutely not sure, not just that they personally wouldn't be able to bring up kids. You know, all of them are pretty sure of themselves. But an issue for them is they don't want to bring children into the world where they're not sure what the future of this world is.
Mariana Muravieva is a professor of Russian law at the University of Helsinki.
Hurling is one of Ireland's national sports. Fans call it the fastest moving field sport in the world. It's something like field hockey or lacrosse. Players use 3-foot-long wooden sticks called hurleys to drive a ball up and down the pitch. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, the national sport is under threat.
If you've never seen a game of hurling, picture two teams, 15 aside, sprinting down a field with players balancing a small hard leather ball, known as a schlitter, on the end of their sticks, or hurleys, usually egged on by some very passionate fans.
Oh my word! We had an absolute fabulous goal in the first half! 82,300 people come alive!
More than 80,000 people crammed into Dublin's Croke Park Stadium this summer to watch that hurling championship final match between counties Cork and Clare. The sport itself dates back centuries.
We know this because of ancient Irish law tracts and of manuscripts kept in Irish monasteries from the medieval period.
Paul Rouse is author of The Hurlers, a book that explores the modern history of the sport.
You see it, for example, being played in London by communities of Irish people in the 1750s. You see it played in Paris before the revolution. You see it played in San Francisco in the 1840s and 1850s. Wherever Irish people went, the game was played.
Rouse says for many in Ireland, the sport became a potent symbol of Irishness, particularly during the country's fight for independence from Britain.
Just before the 1916 Rising, which was an attempt by Irish Republican separatists to overthrow the British rule in Ireland, they did not have guns, so they used hurling sticks as rifles as they went on parade.
Today, the sport is more popular than ever. A hurling match is often referred to as the Clash of the Ash. Hurleys are carved from ash trees, a species native to Ireland. Hurley making has been in Sean Torpy's family for decades.
My granduncle would have been a hurley maker before my father, but only in a pastime capacity. But it's in the family for three generations, I suppose.
When Barack Obama visited Ireland in 2011, the Irish Prime Minister presented him with a hurley made by the Torpys. But the following year, a fungal disease called ash dieback was discovered in Ireland. And the government predicted that around 90% of ash trees will likely succumb to the disease in the next few decades. So hurley maker Sean Torpy began looking for alternatives.
My father first came to me with bamboo and said, look, Sean, there's people, you know, holding up skyscrapers in China with bamboo. So, you know, there's got to be something in that material.
In 2020, after 6 years of research and experimentation, the Torpys produced and sold their first bamboo hurley. Getting all the players on board, though, hasn't been easy.
Players are very cautious about what hurley they use. You know, the hurley is an extension of the arm. There's a connection with it that, you know, you can't really describe in words.
At this summer's championship final, 9 out of the 15 players on the Clare team played with hurleys made from bamboo, including wing forward David Fitzgerald.
Aesthetically, it looks slightly different to ash in terms of the curvature of the grains. The bamboo is kind of straighter, whereas the ash hurley is more curved.
But after a few weeks, Fitzgerald tells me, he could barely tell the difference. Still, he says, he knows some teammates were slow to make the change. Hurley maker Sean Torpy says soon they mightn't have a choice. Anyway, he says, the players from Clare, with their 9 bamboo hurleys, did go on to win the championship final this year. I think, he says, that means we're doing something right. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Hurleys, slithers, they've got good words in Ireland, don't they? You're listening to The World.
Walking across the globe, Paul Salopek's journey has brought him to South Korea, a very different place from the South Korea of the past.
The so-called Hermit Kingdom of 150-some years ago is now an exporter of global pop music and movies, right? TV dramas. It's a cultural powerhouse.
The old and new South Korea, still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Israel looks set to expand its military campaign in Lebanon against Iranian-backed Hezbollah. Meanwhile, people in Iran watch for how Israel will retaliate for the missile attack from Tehran earlier this week. This dangerous moment for the Middle East is putting unprecedented strain on the close alliance between the U.S. and Israel. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
On October 7th last year, the day of the massive Hamas attack from Gaza that killed hundreds of Israelis, Joe Biden went to the podium in the White House and said this.
The United States stands with Israel. We will not ever fail to have their back.
And that has remained consistent. Fast forward almost exactly 1 year, this is National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan speaking Tuesday night, soon after Iran fired nearly 200 missiles at Israel.
The United States military coordinated closely with the Israeli Defense Forces to help defend Israel against this attack.
The image that captures the resiliency of the U.S.-Israeli security relationship came on October 18, 2023, on the tarmac of Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. That's when President Biden walked off Air Force One and literally embraced Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This moment has come to be known as the bear hug. But did it work? Michael Koplow is with the Israel Policy Forum in Washington.
If the idea was to demonstrate that the U.S. was going to stand behind Israel and to keep the Iranians and even Hezbollah to a larger extent out of the fighting in the immediate aftermath of October 7th, then in that case, the bear hug did work.
Biden has kept up with his promise to provide military assistance to the Israelis. He has sent U.S. fighter jets, Navy destroyers, and two aircraft carriers to the region. He's boosted the number of American troops in the Middle East to 43,000. In the last year, the Biden administration has speeded up weapons deliveries to Israel. Washington passed new legislation in August for $20 billion of military aid. And high-level U.S. officials from the Pentagon, State Department, CIA have been traveling regularly to meet with their Israeli counterparts. Michael Koplow says it still didn't take long for real daylight to emerge between the U.S. and Israel.
On the big picture issues, I think the two have been aligned for the past year and remain aligned. But it's when you get into the details where there has been lots of disputes between the two.
U.S. officials became concerned, for example, about the high numbers of Palestinian civilians being killed by the Israeli military in Gaza. Some of those officials decided to resign in protest, including Josh Paul. He worked on security and arms transfers at the State Department for 11 years.
I resigned because I, you know, saw the scale and the scope of the damage that was being done with U.S. arms. I do believe that the U.S. has an important role to play in helping partners for their defensive capabilities. I do not believe that the weapons we provide are intended to be used to kill civilians, certainly not by the thousands, and yet it was clear that that was what was happening.
At various times, President Biden has criticized Israel's military operations in Gaza as indiscriminate and over the top. The administration has also been pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza for months. But Trita Parsi with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft says Benjamin Netanyahu has refused to agree to a deal.
We need an end to this war. Israel needs an end to this war. In the long run, how is Israel going to be secure if it is continuing this massacre of civilians in Gaza?
Parsi says there's a similar dynamic playing out in Lebanon. The Biden administration was working on a truce between Israel and Hezbollah when the Israelis carried out an airstrike that killed Hassan Nasrallah. What has followed is an expanding Israeli ground invasion into southern Lebanon. Trita Parsi says this all goes back to the bear hug nearly a year ago.
I would say that the biggest headline is the near complete abdication by the Biden administration for any responsibility to actually make sure that we pursue U.S. interest instead of this constant deference to the Netanyahu government. Almost anything that Biden administration has warned against, they have made clear that they don't want to see Israel escalate in various theaters, etc. We have seen that the Netanyahu government has been more than happy to ignore.
The Biden administration has tried to alleviate the humanitarian crisis in Gaza over the last year by appointing a high-level State Department official to work on the problem and pressuring Israel to keep border crossings open for aid deliveries. But that has also been a struggle. There's still a big disagreement about what happens after the war in Gaza. The White House has talked about restarting the peace process and creating an independent Palestinian state. This Israeli government rejects the two-state solution and has offered very little in terms of a post-war plan for the Gaza Strip. Michael Koplow from the Israel Policy Forum reckons there's more tension playing out right now behind closed doors about this potentially larger question.
How do the U.S. and Israel coordinate on an Israeli response to Iran that will get Iran to back down without it leading to even more escalation on both sides?
Koplow says there are probably some intense discussions right now between American and Israeli officials about what happens next. Biden says he would not support Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities, but that Israel does have a right to respond proportionally. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
What is a proportional response depends on whom you ask. Nimrod Sheffer is in Jerusalem. He's a former chief of staff for the Israeli Air Force and was a top war planner for the military until 2016. I asked him what he understands about Netanyahu's endgame.
I don't think that any high-ranked officer in the military establishment or the defense establishment in Israel knows what's in Netanyahu's head. And I think that none of the Israeli citizens really know what he's up to. And actually, when you look at the performance of the last year, the simplest answer is that he doesn't have any plan, which is very sad, because I think that the most important question is, how do you take all the benefits from the very successful military actions and create a better future for the state of Israel and probably for the region? And I don't see that.
I mean, there is a sense, as you know, that the prime minister is using war to keep himself in power. If that is the case, can you imagine a kind of a regional war that would not break out, but more like a long, drawn-out series of bloody skirmishes and major human displacement?
The situation now is that Hamas is almost incapable of creating real military actions. Hezbollah was hurt very, very dramatically. Even though I think there are tens of thousands of rockets that still remains in his possession. But I think that as an organization, a military organization, terrorist organization, it lost a lot of its power. And by that, Iran is left without its two major players around Israel, which is Hezbollah and Hamas. And I think it's a situation that the state of Israel, together with its allies, the United States, European and regional allies, can take advantage of and try to create a much better Middle East. It's an opportunity, I think.
What opportunities are you describing or thinking about?
Now Hezbollah is in a weak position and we have to take advantage of that. And I'm afraid that the Israeli leaders will skip that opportunity, because if what you said is correct and Netanyahu is only trying to keep his position as prime minister, he will say, okay, I want this situation to go on.
Are all those evacuated Lebanese who are displaced, is that an opportunity for Hezbollah to gain support at this moment?
I think on the contrary, I think that the Lebanese people understands what Hezbollah created in Lebanon. I just want to remind you that Hezbollah are not an official armed forces in Lebanon. They are holding a much, much stronger military power than the official military of Lebanon. And I think that what the Lebanese people can see is that because Hezbollah has its headquarters in the middle of Beirut, in Dahiya Quarter, because of that, so many people had to leave their homes, and the houses around Hezbollah headquarters were demolished. And also in the villages on the south. Look, when Hezbollah's strategy is to build its launching points in civilian homes, then the citizens of Lebanon should understand, I believe they do, that the outcome will be that the Israeli attack the homes and the houses. And they will have to be evacuated if they want to stay safe. And this is the strategy of terror organization. You saw it in Gaza Strip. You see it again in Lebanon. And Israel should do what it should do, yeah?
Nimrod Shevre, I feel I need to ask you this. There is evidence of possible war crimes committed by the Israeli military that continues to be documented by the troops themselves on TikTok. There's also been torture discovered at one military prison. Why is this happening? Is there a loss of accountability in the Israeli military?
It's devastating to see, and I believe that every single person who committed war crime or any kind of crime should be judged according to the law immediately. And what is even more difficult than that is to see some of the Israeli politicians and members of the Knesset who support those actions and actually trying to support avoiding from investigation. This is awful. I don't support any war crime, and I think should be really immediately taken care of.
Let's return to the current conflict or conflicts. We're expecting, obviously, some kind of answer from Israel to Iran's missile attacks this week. What would a direct war with Iran look like, in your view?
Iran can hit Israel using rockets or missiles, mainly. What we have here is the IDF that could hit Iran on a daily basis. It can look like the following. Israel is attacking targets in Iran that are causing a lot of damage to the Iranian military, the Revolution Guards, and the people of Iran. And Iran can harm from time to time Israel. You just saw what happened to the last attack, 200 missiles. I think that the damage will be incomparable.
Well, Iran's president says he does not want regional war. What would you say to someone who says, you know, try diplomacy first?
We'll see. If he means that, he will suffer the Israeli attack on Iran and say, okay, I don't want a regional war. Let's stop here.
Nimrod Shevre is a former chief of staff for the Israeli Air Force and was a top war planner for the military until 2016. We reached him today in Jerusalem.
Extending a helping hand when that means breaking the rules is not always easy. For Soo Jeon, it was especially hard. Her South Korean parents always reminded her to appreciate how lucky they all were to be in the U.S. Despite this, there was one time when Jeon ignored the rules. She shared what she did on GBH's Stories from the Stage.
It was a Thursday night, and I was at a local church volunteering to serve free meals to those who needed it and came. This was no different than any other Thursday night. My mother and I went there every week to volunteer. Now, I was only 11, and so I really had no business being there. All the other volunteers were adults, but having immigrated from South Korea, my mother was not fluent in English, so I got to come along as a translator. I didn't mind because I kind of got used to being in places I had no business being there to interpret for my mother. I went with her to her doctor's appointments and translated her aches and pains. I even went to my own parent-teacher conference at my school to translate for my teacher on how I was doing to my mother. And I have just come to accept this as my role. Now, this Thursday night, the church was packed because we were serving spaghetti and meatballs, and that was the most popular meal. And once everyone knew that that's what we were serving, everyone came out. This Thursday night was a little different. One of the guests, a lady who was eating dinner there, gestured at me. Now, this was very unusual because normally no one paid any attention to me. So I hesitated, but she just kept gesturing at me. In fact, beckoned me to come to her. So I went. She pulled me aside and asked if she could bring some meatballs home to her children. Now, the rules were you couldn't take food out. And I knew this rule. And yet, I found my head nodding up and down in agreement to her request. And then I walked away. And I walked to the kitchen. And I walked to this sort of secluded area where they also use for storage. And I started to pace back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, figuring out what do I do? I gave my word to this lady. But on the other hand, it was breaking a rule. And I remember my mother's words just echoing in my head with something she used to tell me over and over and over again. She said to me, "Sue, don't embarrass yourself. Don't embarrass your family, and don't embarrass everyone that you represent. Because as an immigrant, You never want to make this country regret letting you in. But her kids are going to go hungry if I don't pull through. And I know what it feels like to not have things. But on the other hand, I also remember my mother telling me once that coming here was very important to her, that as an immigrant and as someone who didn't speak English very well, that it was one of the few places where people were happy to see her. People welcomed her. So I continued to pace back and forth, trying to figure out what do I do? And I spotted some paper coffee cups. And I had an idea. I went over to the stove and I took that paper coffee cup and I put in meatballs. In fact, I remember smashing it down so I could fit as much as I possibly could. I put a lid on it and I walked over to the lady. And when the lady saw me coming, she stood up and she knew exactly what was in those coffee cups. And when she and I met, she just gently took the coffee cup from me. No words were exchanged. She turned one way, and I turned the other. Now, I have no idea how the word got around, but many a guest approached me that night. Rather, it was a look or a glance, I knew exactly what they wanted. And every time someone approached me, I went into the kitchen, quickly looked around to make sure that no one saw me, and I put some meatballs in there, put a lid on it, and passed it out. And every time I did that, no one really thanked me. But let's just say many a paper coffee cups left the church that night. It turns out even as a kid, I knew, or maybe because I was a kid, I just knew to do the right thing, you never need permission. Thank you.
Sue John's story is one of many on Stories from the Stage on GBH's World TV. You can hear more on worldchannel.org.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Paul Salopek has put a lot of mileage on his legs and feet. I mean, a lot. It took the National Geographic Explorer 28 months just to walk across China. Salopek is determined to complete his Out of Eden walk across the globe. His next stop after China is South Korea. Foot and shoe as Paul approaches an old fort at Incheon. Incheon is a large coastal city near the border with North Korea. It has a long history of Americans popping up along its shores. Salopek is with us to talk about his last 2 months walking through South Korea. So before we dive into your walk through South Korea, Paul, we have a clip from your last entry from China. Let's hear that. La, la. Describe what we're hearing there, Paul. Where are you?
Yes, that's at a restaurant near Dalian in far northeastern China, in what used to be called Manchuria. And about 20 of my Chinese walking partners gathered there to walk with me the last kilometers to the LOC, the finish line in my China walk.
Wow. So moving from China, where you'd spent a lot of time on foot, especially in some rural areas, taking a car ferry across the Yellow Sea, you put China in the rear view, as it were. What was that experience like after more than 2 years immersed in the People's Republic?
You know, Marco, honestly, I think I'm still processing it. You know, more than 2.5 years and on foot, mostly, as you mentioned, in rural China, then to show up at a very busy, heavily industrialized port in South Korea, heavily globalized country. Everybody's heard of K-pop. And it was like coming through, you know, an Alice in Wonderland mirror, right?
Yeah, so what else is remarkable about Incheon? And this is where you started your walking journey in South Korea.
Yeah, well, you know, for students of history, Incheon, if Americans remember anything at all about Incheon, it's a somewhat less remembered American war, the Korean War. Back in 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea, and Incheon was where General Douglas MacArthur staged an amphibious assault to push back the North Koreans, right, to what is today the current dividing line, the 38th parallel between North and South Korea. But even less known was an even older first contact between these two nations that have a long and braided history together between America and Korea. And that was called the Shinmyeongyo, which is the first kind of American expedition to try to open up what was then called the Hermit Kingdom to American commerce and diplomacy. The Americans sent 5 gunboats in the 19th century in 1871 to force this issue.
So, I mean, this history of American expansionism seems to be occurring in multiple parts of the globe at the same time. What impact would you say this expansionism had on Korea itself?
It was part of a continuum of foreign incursions into the peninsula. The Joseon dynasty that ruled the peninsula at that time was very aware of sort of Western military, political, cultural expansion in this part of Asia. They knew that China had been forced to open trade ports. The Opium War had happened in China. Matthew Perry, the American Commodore, had forced Japan to open its ports to American trade a few decades earlier, 1854. And indeed, only about a quarter of a century after this Korean first contact at the muzzle of cannons, the U.S. had a war with Spain over the Philippines and basically annexed the Philippines in 1898.
Yeah, so prior to interactions like all of these, Korea was known as the Hermit Kingdom. You kind of dropped that notion a few minutes ago. There's an interesting story behind that, though. Explain.
So when the Americans came in 1871, they were ostensibly looking for another lost American ship called the General Sherman, which had disappeared in that area 5 years previously. In fact, the ship had been sunk and the American crew killed. And when they arrived, typically, as always happened, they said, "We want to come and talk to you about this." The Koreans either don't reply or they say, "Please go away."
So in your latest post, you also talk about meeting a descendant of a Korean resistance leader who fought against the U.S. invasion in 1871. What did he tell you? And did you get any sense why the U.S. might have thought it would be successful at either pacifying or shaking hands with the Koreans?
Yeah, Mr. Yeo is the great-great-grandson of Commander Yeo, who led the Korean forces. Now, at this time in the 1870s, Korea was still basically a feudal society. They were still using old bronze cannons and matchlock muskets that were basically designed on 16th century or 17th century Portuguese weapons.
Yeah, you describe that something that's like positively medieval.
Yes, exactly. Whereas the Americans, again, coming out of the Civil War, had some of the most modern military technology in the world at that time.
Ultimately, though, what happened in this 1871 conflict?
Well, you know, it was sort of predictable. Basically, they defeated the Korean defenders, killing more than 350 of them, some of whom apparently committed suicide rather than surrender. Among the dead was Mr. Yeo's, the historian I met in Incheon, his great-great-grandfather, who was last seen charging the American guns with a broken sword in one hand and a bag of musket balls in the other. And when I went to these sites, these old forts, these Korean forts that defended the mouth of the Han River and that battled the Americans, They're still there. They seem a bit kind of dusty and neglected. Me and my walking partner were basically the only people there. They didn't seem to be that well visited. And the signage, interestingly, was kind of very careful, you know, very carefully worded to kind of make it seem kind of a neutral perspective.
Yeah, those are the footsteps we heard earlier when we started walking up to that fort. South Korea, at least, is no longer part of any hermit kingdom. How would you describe the country's position today, though, amid ongoing globalization?
Well, this is what's one of the rich ironies of history, right? The kind of who gets the last laugh. And there's no kind of occupation without counter-occupation. The so-called hermit kingdom of 150-some years ago is now an exporter of global pop music and movies, right? TV dramas. It's a cultural powerhouse. South Korea punches way above its weight in terms of the kind of audience that it has globally for its cultural exports. I mean, there are K-pop fans in Angola, you know, as well as, you know, in the United States. It's pretty amazing. And it's kind of like, you know, somebody gets the last joke, as it were.
Right. How did it feel to return to a place where U.S. chain stores are visible again?
Marco, I've been on this project continuously, you know, walking out of Ethiopia towards the tip of South America, following the footsteps of the ancestors. And what some readers don't realize is I don't go home. I mean, this is a continuous journey. So I've been walking since 2013. The last time I was in the U.S. was December of 2012.
Wow.
Obama was still in office. And so hearing about these kind of chain stores and the familiar junk foods, it was like, again, stepping through the mirror in Alice in Wonderland out of kind of a time capsule.
You are a spaceman on Earth, Paul.
Or Rip Van Winkle, one of the two. Yeah, so.
Paul Salopek is a National Geographic explorer. He spent the past 2 months in South Korea on his Out of Eden walk. Paul, as always, thanks for sharing your journeys and insights. And until the next time.
Always a pleasure, Margo. Thank you.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you so much for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Patchwork Collective, Lillianne and Ed Schneider, the Gruber Family Foundation, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Helen and Russell Pine. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.